amidst adamant, his strength, his might, his speed, his fight. He's adamant, that tiny ant, and his atomic power. As what it takes and always makes the vilest villain cower. He's rough, he's tough, and bad guys yell it up when he is up and adamant.
Cleo writes, hello. A few times now you've joked on your show about not having any fans or never getting a lot of fan mail, so I decided it was only right to show I care. Your podcast, definitely a favorite of mine. I'm obviously an anime fan. I happen to be in high school at the moment, and I have to admit that I'm ashamed of my fandom. You see, I also love to draw. Every year I go to fine arts camp on the west coast of Michigan, and you can split all art students into two types of people, fans of anime and anime haters. The second you say, I like anime, you're automatically bombarded with a mob of people telling you how much you suck, and a mob of people telling you how, OMG, I want to carry Inuyasha's babies forever!
I've actually heard that statement made. I want, what is it that Ali says all the time?
I
want
to have
millions
of your... I want to have 10 million of his babies.
Of his babies.
Yeah, okay. The same thing happens in school to much milder extent. Once you're seen with manga or you have a picture that's mildly Japanese... You're treated like, oh no, Johan is snapping.
Can I ruin this anymore?
No. Okay.
Okay. The same thing happens in school to a much milder extent. Once you're seen with manga or you have a picture that's mildly Japanese, you're treated like some brain-dead fangirl. Sure, I watch anime, I read manga, check out AMVs, dream of going to conventions, and even draw in a Japanese style on occasion. But that doesn't mean I scream in glee when I see it on TV or that I use Japanese in my daily conversations. I do use it.
Now, actually, hold on
there
for a minute, because...
That's called squeeing.
Squeeing.
Well, that's what Val calls it.
Well, it's called squeeing. So I recently watched Trekkies 2. You may have seen the original Trekkies documentary.
I haven't seen either one. I probably
should. Well, Aaron, that's because...
I'm a slacker.
Yeah, you're a slacker.
Well,
you
should be watching
everything all the time.
But I also thought it would portray my people badly.
Well, but you wouldn't know because you didn't see it.
No.
So maybe you'd like to see it, but there's actually a point that's made in Trekkies 2 about the difference between a Trekkie and a Trekker. Trekkie is the derogatory term. Trekker is what fans wish to be known as. A woman, perhaps in her 50s, is speaking with the documentarian and says, Trekkies are the people who, when they see a cast member, scream and run down the aisle to the front of the auditorium, waving their arms wildly. That's a Trekkie. I'm a Trekker. I'm excited to see them too, but I walk. And that's something that I think I can really appreciate. There is an enormous difference between being the, I don't know, anime version of a Bobby Soxer.
No, it's called being a fangirl.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I think of myself as a fangirl, but there's also, like, a difference to me between me and someone writing Kenshin fanfiction and squeeing over, you know, it used to be a few years ago, Kenshin. People would always dress as Kenshin, and a bunch of girls would be like, oh my god, you're Kenshin, he's so cute. But I think then it kind of took a turn, and it became Inuyasha, that suddenly there were, like, a million Inuyasha fangirls who were squeeing. Now, don't get me wrong. Like, I think Inuyasha is an okay show if you watch it through once, but it's kind of ruined for me by being on Cartoon Network. Not so much that the dub is bad, that the dub is bad for the first 10 or so episodes, but then eventually Kagome settles down a little bit. It's just, it got rerun a lot, only for a few, like the first 50 episodes or so, maybe less, until I finally got so sick of it, like the same episodes over and over again. But I bought a little Shippo doll and the little fox.
Kilala, okay.
We need an idea.
And Shippo. He's Shippo. He's a hell of a guy. I like Shippo.
That's too quiet. Now Noah's conflating. There's a song...
I'm sure it'll be in the show notes.
On the Brack show called Hippo.
Yeah, Hippo.
Hippo is Brack's stuffed animal. And
he's a stuffed lobster.
Stuffed lobster.
He's nice.
Okay.
Go back to the letter.
So, your show digs me out of my anime shame hole and reminds me to make time for the stuff I love. Sorry for the rant there, but there was a compliment at the end which should make everything better. I was thinking I should draw you fan art for your site, but I figured you're both artists, right? Well, at least Aaron...
Not me.
Yeah, I saw Noah's drawing once.
Shut up. That drawing was awesome. It was of a guy with boots.
Okay. Well, at least Aaron is, and I figured that if you really wanted more art for your webpage, you'd make it yourself. Which leads me to my great quest of what you actually do for a living. As I stated before, I'm an artist. For some reason, that sounds like I'm tooting my own horn. I don't mean to. So when you mentioned that you do something related to animation, my interests are perked. So your station's somewhat mainstream. I was narrowing it down to Cartoon Network, Nick, and the Anime Network. It's obviously not Anime Network, because your coworkers don't share your enjoyment of anime. You live in New York, and from what I've heard, Nick works mostly in California. Which isn't true, really. It has an office in New York, too. Oh, well. Whoops. Then she's like, so you work with Cartoon Network? Will you ever tell us? Oh, well. My last statement is regarding AMVs and cutting on time. Your discussion on such things and on Aaron's cosplaying reminded me of one of my favorite AMVs. And it's for one that's like a Beatles song that's cut to a bunch of Studio Ghibli stuff.
Did I see this?
Maybe a long time ago. It's not my favorite AMV. There's not like an overriding theme.
We'll put the link in the show notes.
Yeah. Love your work. P.S. G4 PowerBooks make walls fall. Nice to hear you have one too.
Now go back, because I think, see, the people want to know. They want to know what you do for a living.
Okay, so... Have you seen Paranoia Agent? I hope so. You should have seen Paranoia Agent by now. Come on, it's only 13 episodes. Look, okay, there's the animation episode of Paranoia Agent, and the guy who has the worst time is the production coordinator. And that's what I do. I'm a production coordinator. Now, I don't drive tapes to the station where they're airing them, because we do things much more ahead of time. I think that's a really creative exaggeration. I don't think anyone is driving tapes to the studio the day before they air. And no one is stepping on my head and telling me to die, because we have a really nice director on our show, and also nothing's going horribly, horribly wrong. Yeah, I do a bunch of odds and ends, like IDing storyboards and updating the opening and ending credits and shipping tapes, all recreation, and a lot of other kind of random things. What a production coordinator does kind of varies from production to production. That's what I do. It's not creative hardly at all, and I don't really get to draw anything. But that doesn't really bother me. My drawing is not great. Like, it's okay, but there are a lot of... The storyboard artists are all really great artists, and they can draw really well, really fast. And that's something I can't do. Like, I could draw something really well, but it's going to take a while.
A note just on... I thought that I was going to work in the industry, and indeed I worked in television for a little while. But I was under the impression that everyone there really wanted to be there. I thought that, for instance, if you go to work at the Science Fiction Network, the Sci-Fi Channel, everyone there would be a big nerd. Turns out, not the case, and I cannot stress this enough. Turns out, lots of people just want a job like everyone else, and it happens to be in genre, it's a paycheck, and the way that your job might feel to you, their job feels to them. Not to put down anyone working at the Cartoon Network, because I think it is an instance where the people there really do, at least the people in programming, really do love what they work on, and they wouldn't have this kind of following if they didn't really respect animation and enjoy it as fans. But in general, you will find in the industry, most people are just trying to make a buck and get by. Let that be a lesson to you out there, anyone who is as naive as I was. You can, of course, find good people wherever you go. Don't expect that the world is populated by fanish people,
because
it's not.
The show that I work on, we're lucky enough to have a lot of people who work on it who are really geeky. Like, a lot of the artists really love American comic books, and there are people, there are a handful of us there who really do like manga and anime, and the director of the show really likes anime too.
Yeah.
And that's really encouraging. He has like a Kiki's Delivery Service cell in his office, and like a really good Porco Rosso cell too, and I'm so jealous. I'm like, I wish I was there.
We've got our one golden boy cell.
We got an awesome golden boy cell at Anime Expo for like
it is 10, awesome.
For like $10. It's
not Miyazaki.
No, we can't afford the Miyazaki cells. I wish I was a bigwig to the point where executives are buying me Ghibli cells as gifts. That'd be sweet. Anyway, no, so the other people who work on the show are mostly American comic book fans, but that's really great, because that means they like a lot of the same things that I like, even if I'm not really into superheroes. I'd rather be in an office where people are discussing superheroes than an office where people don't read comic books at all. Like, it's awesome. Once in a while on Wednesdays, they'll be like, oh, new comic book day, let's walk down to Forbidden Planet or whatever.
Yeah, and I'm very envious. I work at a law firm, and there's not that sense at all.
Yeah.
I've never worked, no matter how hard I looked, I couldn't really find a place that was sufficiently geeky for me. Instead, I settled for a paycheck.
What's really weird is, so in the color department of the show that we work on, they make the color models to send to Korea, and our color coordinator really likes Dian Angel. Well, she likes the art from it. I don't think she's necessarily watched the anime of it. I don't think it's the same as the manga, but the artist is really neat. So Then we went to Korea, and we saw Rough Draft Korea. In their color department, they had a big Dan Angel poster.
Yeah.
It's the same, both places. Okay, we'll do one more thing. Okay, so we're going to start a new segment called, Oh My God, I Can't Believe You Haven't Seen Blank.
Something that you should have seen already, and I can't believe that you haven't seen it. You're a big slacker. Stop listening to this right now. Go out and get whatever it is this week.
We need to know what the title is first.
Right.
What I'm going to assume.
Yes, which is what we're going to do now.
So we need like a reverb theme thing. Oh my God, I can't believe I haven't seen this.
OMFG, why haven't you seen this?
Wings of Oniamis.
Yeah.
Do you think
I thought that was going to be mine. No, go. Dude, go.
What do you mean mine? We're going to both chip in.
Oh, all right. Well, go ahead.
Oh my God, I can't believe you haven't seen Wings of Oniamis. It's the earliest Gainax feature film. It's so good.
It's extraordinarily good.
It's really old. Why haven't you seen it? You should have, when you watched Otaku no Video and you saw them waiting in line for that, you should have thought, I need to see that too.
All of the excellent science fiction, I think, in the past 15 or so years hasn't come out in novel form. We're only now just starting to get good science fiction back on television. It's all been in anime. Wings of Oniamis is the story of a planet that is not unlike ours attempting to make their first baby steps into space. They are where we were perhaps in the early 60s in regards to the space flight, manned space flight. And really, there just isn't enough interest in getting someone into space until one guy decides that he's going to step up to the plate and starts training as an astronaut. And this sets off the remaining events in the movie, which, of course, you know, turn out to be very resounding, whereby this small gesture of him deciding that it's a worthwhile goal to go out into space has enormous implications for the whole planet.
In the movie, there's like a Royal Space Force that's a bunch of old men who have these weird sort of uniforms, but you can tell it's like they haven't really made that initiative to actually send someone into space, but it's been a dream of, I thought it was just like an alternate version of Earth. Okay, but they haven't, like, they just haven't made that leap yet. And it takes one young man's ambition to actually, and at first he's kind of reluctant, too, where he's like, he's not very serious about it, but then he suddenly gets very serious.
And it captures a feeling that I don't think we really have anymore, and haven't for at least the past 90 years or so, which is that amateurs can make some kind of real contribution to science and the development of mankind, where you had the Wright brothers, who were just these two schlubs, who decided that they were going to get someone into the air. And they worked on it and worked on it and worked on it as hobbyists until they were finally successful. And of course, it was, as they say, a paradigm shift. Now, when you think of technological development, you're thinking in terms of giant corporations and governments,
but you also
not
think it,
really
you think of it as a couple
dedicated
of,
hobbyists.
But yeah, but computers are like, they start off with some guys in California in their garage with
yeah.
a box and blinking lights.
And it was the same, that's absolutely true, it was the same with the computer revolution.
Technological contributions can be great from hobbyists. But I was going with, there's also a big theme in the movie where it's like the planet is kind of at war, and they're putting more of their resources towards the war than towards putting someone into space. So there's a scene where they're going to have a liftoff, but right in the same field where the rocket's taking off, tanks are rolling up, and it's going to be a problem if they accidentally get shot at. So there's, you know, this theme where science is equated to peace in the movie, and if we can just give war a backseat. But I don't know, I think that's kind of not the way it actually works, since the Cold War really catapulted us
into
space.
Yeah, well, and you may, in fact, but now the listeners have to go out and watch it, you know, make their own interpretation. But the point is, this is a really landmark film. It's something that doesn't get talked up enough. It is probably, perhaps not as exciting, but better science fiction than Akira. A lot of people find Akira to be somewhat incomprehensible after a point.
Yeah, oh.
And like, this does not suffer
from
that.
Like after the first 5 minutes.
Oh, that's... that when weak I first, people think
I, look,
that.
No, when I first saw Akira, I saw it in high school, and I really hadn't watched a lot of anime. So I came away from the film with three questions that was something like, what's going on here? What's wrong with these people anyway? And when is this movie going to be over? Because it seemed like it dragged on, particularly the third act just isn't structural. I've seen it again since then, and thanks to Noah's extensive explanations, I understand more of what was happening. But there was something about it, like this incomprehensible quality. But actually, when I really first started watching anime in high school, when I watched Sailor Moon, the first few times I watched it, there was something bizarre about like the visual language, where it was something I didn't get at all. Like, you know, it seemed like something was going on here, and I was missing it because it was incomprehensible. And eventually that kind of wore off, where like you watch more and more anime till finally it's like, oh, it makes sense when that happens, or their nose bleeds when they're horny or whatever. But you don't know that right when you start. But I think that's part of the thing that draws in anime fans. It's like this kind of mysterious thing where there's visual symbol stuff happening that you don't understand. Although the only times I've felt that more recently is when I watched something like Shamaniac Princess, where I'm like, there's got to be some manga this is based on, because this isn't making any sense. And then I found out there was no manga. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Huh.
It's really pretty.
That's strange. I don't know. When I first saw Akira, it was like a steel-toed kick to the nats. I don't think I slept for a couple of days after that because I was digesting it. And still, every time I see it, I come away with a feeling that I don't get from anything else except maybe the very end of the 1977 Star Wars.
Well,
you feel reborn.
Now, see, Noah can really identify with the characters in Akira because he's psychic and they kept him in this academy where...
That's true, but I think it's coincidental overall. I think that...
and Japanese psychic academies are really different.
That's true, although it's funny because I do tend to identify with that aspect of Japanese society where you're always studying for an exam, like always, your entire life. Like when you watch His and Her Circumstances and everything, you have all of these activities in your life, but it all sort of a locust, all of those points is your exams. That's how I felt growing up. I don't know about everyone else.
I went to really easy schools that it didn't really matter. Like, you could just study 5 minutes before, and if you put in the effort, you would be in the top five because no one else really cared.
I was in a harder high school program, and at the time, I really thought that if the world was a meritocracy, I'd do very well. But now seeing how Japanese society is painted in these anime, I feel like maybe it's a good thing.
Do you know what, I mean, I don't think a lot of our listeners know what a meritocracy is, since I had to learn what that was like 3 years ago.
Okay.
But it's really cool.
Yeah, if you're good at taking tests.
In theory. You can explain it.
Sure. Meritocracy is, for instance, in the ancient Chinese tradition, everything is dependent on exams and examinations, and the meritocratic system puts you through schools, and your status in society depends on the extent of your scholarly accomplishments and achievements.
Right, so the better you do on the test, the more likely you are to be present.
Essentially.
Something like that.
Yeah, but you see this a lot in China and Korea, even now.
Like if you go to Tokyo University, then you can be in the government.
Absolutely.
Like a third of Japanese government officials went to Tokyo University. But Tokyo University itself, I did a lot of reading up on it, particularly in the book Speed Tribes, Days and Nights with Japan's Youngest Generation, which was written in the early 90s, so a lot of stuff has changed since then, but it's a good book to read about stuff about Japan that you don't really hear about normally, because he hangs out with sort of underground types. But there's a chapter on Tokyo University where they talk a lot about how the hardest part of Tokyo University is just the entrance exam, but people study their whole lives starting from preschool just to get in. Like, they go to, like, special extra studying preschools and cram schools to get into the best kindergartens, to get into the best elementary schools, to get into the best junior highs, to get into the best high schools.
Right.
And finally, to get into Tokyo U. But once you actually attend Tokyo U, it's kind of slackery. Like, it doesn't matter.
Because
even if you graduate with the lowest grade in your class, people will hire you just because you went to Tokyo University. Like, there's a great part where this one guy works at a company and he says, if you work in HR and you hire someone from Tokyo University and he turns out to be an idiot, no one will blame you because he went to Tokyo U. And, like, in a really small company, people will, like, employees will look out once in a while to look, to just look at their employee from Tokyo University.
Right.
As a kind of mascot. Like, it gives them good luck.
It's a badge of honor. And listeners might be already very familiar with this concept, watching something like Love Hina.
Well, I don't think the gravity of that comes through. I think Love Hina is very popular, but the protagonist is an idiot, and it's
true.
The implication isn't there. Like, it's not explained to you in Love Hina that if he gets in here, he's set for life.
But it is explained that they've been counting on this, on going to Tokyo University. Since they were
because the two main characters, they didn't really think about trying for it until 4 years ago or something.
No, that can't be true at all, because he made the promise.
13 volumes of the manga. Oh, yeah, he did make the promise with her,
yeah,
like, as a preschooler.
Right.
But he didn't attend the best schools and stuff. He didn't get really serious about it until he was in high school.
Well, that's because Kitaro is an idiot. Or in Golden Boy.
Oh, he is.
As the end narration tells you. Kintaro Oi is what, a 23-year-old?
Yeah,
he was enrolled in Tokyo University
in the law
school
program, which is even harder to get into.
But he dropped out. Now,
even though he'd completed all of the courses, he drops out before graduation. So you should know from that narration, if you live in Japan, you know about Tokyo University, then you know automatically that Kitaro is supposed to be some kind of genius.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really necessarily come off to American viewers, because it's not really in the text that Tokyo University is supposedly as hard as Oxford, Harvard, and all of the Ivy League universities combined.
Right.
But we were talking about Tokyo U. Look, back to Wings of Onyamas.
Okay.
Wings of Onyamas has a terrific ending. I don't want to give it away, but you know that kind of cutting where they cut to things that it's not a motion cut, it's not a shape cut, it's a symbolic cut? Yeah, an old Russian
director. Oh, Eisenstein you're talking about. Okay.
Ah, you got it.
Sure.
Eisenstein invented that kind of cutting, which only people who went to film school would know about or care about.
Montage, they like to call it.
But it's not montage. No, there's another word for it.
It is montage.
I guess. But it's like, there are different... It's not... Montage is like more fading. I don't know.
No, it isn't.
I'm going to look this up later.
Well, you can, because it's called montage.
So
but,
I will. Anyway, it ends with a great montage that really drives home the importance of space travel. Because that's... Wings of Onyamas is really about space. Isn't that the most important thing?
Right.
Isn't that the greatest human achievement we made in the last century? And you forget, you know, in your day-to-day... Maybe Noah doesn't forget.
Well, I should be so lucky if I forget, but it's true. There's that film and 2001. At the end of both of them, I am... stunned, because I have this transcendent feeling that, oh my God, one day we're going to go into space, and what that really means. One day this is really going to happen, and all of the science fiction that I've read, it's all going to be true, but symbolically it's going to be true, in that eventually we will find a cheap means of space travel. And, I mean, it's then everything, my God, and it's all, everything is different. You know, there's no going back after that.
Crap, I think you're right in this whole montage.
Well, I'm sorry. Who has the film degree here?
Both of us?
It certainly
is.
No,
what's the difference between symbolic cutting and, like, literal cutting? Well, it's a cutting between action and then cutting between scenes that are metaphorically linked, but not actually on the set.
That's true.
It's a ridiculous kind of cutting that no one does anymore. That's my point.
That's...
Like, they cut in Wings of Onyamas from a scene of a rocket ship to a scene of a caveman drawing on a wall. That's not a literal cut. There are no cavemen in this film. It's a metaphoric cut to tell you that this is how important space travel is. That it's so important that it's like the finding... It's like the discovery of fire.
Yeah.
It's like the first human word ever written. It's not a literal cut.
That I would agree with.
That's now, not there's, the there's, forerunner of MTV.
No, cutting. But there's another... We're talking about Eisenstein and his theory of montage that I guess listeners can now tune in to our film theory podcast where we will pick this up later.
This book changed my life.
What, Understanding Movies?
Yes,
did it really?
By Louis Gianetti. It's the first film class I ever took.
You had to read that off the cover. How much did it change your life? You can't remember
the author's
name.
That it's called Understanding Movies by some Italian guy. The most I ever threw up.
And that's going to change my life
forever. I love that Simpsons quote where Homer is like, those three books that change your life. Does Son of Sniglet count?
No.
No. Katharine Hepburn's Me? No. Is TV Guide a book? No.
No.
Till eventually he's finishing his college entrance essay, and it was the most I ever threw up, and it changed my life forever.
That's a good question. Maybe we can use this material for a future podcast. What books or films changed your life? Because Akira is definitely one of mine.
Since we're like an anime podcast, we could say what anime series changed your life. But inevitably, it's going to be whatever the first thing is that people watched and really liked.
Well, that's true to an extent, and that's important. But Akira was certainly not the first thing I watched. We're an anime podcast, but it all comes together.